say it's you, Mr. Wilkes. That poor Mrs. Wilkes were not even a pincushion ready. Don't say it's you, Mr. Wilkes. So the gentleman's dead then, sir. Oh, the more's the pity. But it's what we all must come to. It's as certain as being born, except that we can't make our calculations as exact. Oh, dear. Poor dear. When Gamp was summoned to his long home, and I seen him lying in the hospital with a penny piece on each eye and his wooden leg under his left arm, I thought I should have fainted it away. But I bore up. If it weren't for the nerve a little sip of liquor gives me, I could never go through with what I sometimes has to do. As I said to my friend, Mrs. Harris, at the very last case as ever I acted in, which it was but a young person, Mrs. Harris, I said, leave the bottle on the chimney piece and don't ask me to take none. But let me put my lips to it when I'm so disposed, and I will do everything I've been engaged to do according to the best of my ability. Mrs. Gamp, she says in answer, if ever there was a sober creature to be had for 18 pence a day for working people, 3 and 6 for gentlefolk, night watching being extra charge, you are that invaluable person. Mrs. Harris, I says to her, don't name the charge, I beg. For if I could afford to lay out all my fellow creatures for nothing, I would gladly do so. Such is the love I bear them. Oh, thank you, Mr. Mould. How are you, Mr. Mould? Oh, everything be very nice and comfortable about the deceased. You knows me of old, I hope. So does Mrs. Mould, your handsome partner, and them two sweet young ladies, your daughters. Although the blessing of a daughter was denied myself. The which, if we had one, Gamp would certainly have drunk its little shoes right off its feet. Them two sweet young ladies are yours, as I'd known afore. A tooth in their pretty heads was cut, and a many a time seen, oh, the dear creatures are playing at buryings down in the shop. The order book to its long home in the iron safe. Young ladies with faces such as your daughters thinks of something else besides buryings, don't they, sir? Eh? Thinks of marryings, don't they, sir? I takes new bread, my dear. There was just a little pat of fresh butter and a morsel of cheese. And whatever you do, young woman, don't you bring me more than a shilling's worth of gin and water when I rings the bell a second time. For that is always my allowance, and I never takes a drop beyond. Rich folks may ride on camels, but it ain't so easy for them to see out of a needle's eye. That's my comfort, and I hope I knows it. Drat the old vexatious creature. Almost forgot your pillow, I declare. Now, you're as comfortable as you need be. And I'm going to be comfortable too.
That was Sarah Gamp from Martin Chuzzlewit, and I'm Miriam Margolyes from Clapham. Mr. Mould, the undertaker, was a great admirer of Mrs. Gamp's. He said of her, she was the sort of woman you would bury for nothing and do it neatly. I've been a great admirer of Dickens, a passionate admirer, all my life. And I want to share with you my relish in his humour and variety and vitality. Dickens distilled his life's experience into the most marvellous essence, and particularly the women in his life fueled the women in the works. Now, I know everyone thinks of Dickens as the warm, jolly family man, the paterfamilias, the inventor of Christmas. God bless us, everyone, said Tiny Tim, and so on. But there was a tormented, demonic side to his character, which had its roots in the darkness of his childhood. His daughter, Kate Perugini, knew this. Long after Dickens died, she wrote to George Bernard Shaw, "If you could make the public understand that my father was not a jolly, jocose gentleman walking about the earth with a plum pudding and a bowl of punch, you would greatly oblige me. And I want to oblige Kate now." Dickens could write about the gripe of poverty, about people on the edge of existence, on the underbelly of life, because he'd been there himself. Do you know the Clems from The Uncommercial Traveller? "I am waited on by an elderly woman with a chronic sniff, who at the shadowy hour of 9:30 of every evening gives admittance at the street door to a meagre and mouldy old man, whom I have never yet seen detached from a flat pint of beer in a pewter pot. The meagre and mouldy old man is her husband, and the pair have a dejected consciousness that they are not justified in appearing on the surface of the earth. They come out of some hole when London empties itself and go in again when it fills. They make their bed in the lowest and remotest corner of the basement, and they smell of bed, have no possessions but bed, unless it be, which I rather gather from an undercurrent of flavour in them, cheese. The most extraordinary circumstance I have traced in connection with this aged couple is that there is a Miss Clem, their daughter, apparently 10 years older than either of them, who also has a bed and smells of it, and carries it about the earth at dusk and hides it in deserted houses. I came into this piece of information through Mrs. Clem's beseeching me to sanction the sheltering of Miss Clem under my roof for a single night.
Between taking care of the upper part in Pall Mall, which the family of his back, and else is Sir James's Street, which the family of Leavestown tomorrow."
I gave my gracious consent, and in the shadowy hours, Miss Clem became perceptible on the doorstep, wrestling with a bed in a bundle. Where she made it up for the night, I cannot positively state, but I think in a sink. I know that with the instinct of a reptile or an insect, she stowed it and herself away in deep obscurity. Dickens toured all over the British Isles and America doing his dramatic readings. They were enormously successful. In New York in 1868, more than 40,000 people came to hear him, and he made far more money out of his readings than he ever did out of his writings. I suppose most people's view of a typical Dickens heroine is somebody like Pet Meagles from Little Dorrit. Pet was about 20. a fair girl with rich brown hair hanging free in natural ringlets. A lovely girl with a frank face and wonderful eyes. So large, so soft, so bright, set to perfection in her kind, good head. She was round and fresh and dimpled and spoilt. And there was in Pet an air of timidity and dependence, which was the best weakness in the world. And then there's Kate Nickleby, a slight but very beautiful and gentle girl of about 17. And Mary Graham from Martin Chuzzlewit, no more than 17. Her figure, slight as became her years, but all the charms of youth and maidenhood clustered on her gentle brow. And Ada Clare from Bleak House, with the fire shining on her, a beautiful girl of 17. With such soft blue eyes and such a bright, innocent and trusting face. And Alice, from the Three Sisters of York, a fair creature of 17. The heart of this fair girl bounded with youth and gladness. Her gleesome voice and merry laughs were the sweetest music of their home. She was its very light and life. Have you noticed they're all about 17? That's because they were all based on Mary Hogarth, Dickens' young sister-in-law, who came to live with Dickens and his wife Catherine when they were first married. And the important thing to remember about Mary is that she died at 17. They'd been to the theatre together, the three of them. Dickens loved to go out with a sister on each arm. He called them my pair of petticoats, my two Venuses. And after a visit to the St. James's Theatre, they'd come home, happy and laughing. Mary had gone upstairs to take off her cloak. Dickens was walking upstairs behind her, and suddenly she fell back into his arms and died. He had a pathological attachment to her. He wrote, "Her last words were of me. I have lost the dearest friend I ever had. She had not a single fault and was in life almost as far above the foible and vanity of her sex and age as she is now in heaven." He wanted to be buried in her grave with her and was most upset when her younger brother died first and was buried there instead. He wrote, "It is a great trial to me to give up Mary's grave, greater than I can express. I thought of having her moved to the catacombs and saying nothing about it. I cannot bear the thought of being parted from her dust." He composed the epitaph on her tombstone in Kensal Green Cemetery. "Young, beautiful and good, God numbered her among his angels at the tender age of 17. And she became, in his writings, the pregenitor of all those tiny little mini-breasted prepubescent child love objects, like Rose Maley, Ruth Pinch, Florence Dombey, Little Dorrit, and, of course, Little Nell. I find them all rather icky, actually, for obvious reasons. So did Oscar Wilde. He wrote, "One would have to have a heart of stone to read the death of Little Nell without laughing." And G.K. Chesterton, who was a brilliant Dickens commentator, wrote, "Around Little Nell, of course, a controversy raged and rages. Some implored Dickens not to kill her at the end of the story. Some regret that he did not kill her at the beginning." So I thought it would be nice to show Little Nell having some fun for a change before she died. So here she is with Mrs. Jarley, the owner of the waxwork from the old curiosity shop.
"There, child, read that."
Nell walked around and read aloud the inscription in enormous black letters. "Jarley's Wax Work.
I never saw any waxwork, Mom. Is it funnier than punch?
Funnier?
Said Mrs. Jarley in a shrill voice. It is not funny at all. Oh, said Nell, with all possible humility.
It is not funny at all,
repeated Mrs. Jarley.
It's calm and, oh, what's that word again? Critical? No, that's not it. Classical, that's it. It's calm and classical. No low beatings and knockings about. No jokings and squeakings like your precious punches. But always the same, with a constantly unchanging air of coldness and gentility. And so like life, that if waxwork only spoke and walked about, you'd hardly know the difference. Well, I won't go so far as to say that as it is, I've seen waxwork quite like life. But I've certainly seen some life that was exactly like waxwork. That, ladies and gentlemen, is Jasper Packlemerton of atrocious memory, who courted and married 14 wives and destroyed them all by tickling the soles of their feet while they were sleeping in the consciousness of innocence and virtue. On being brought to the scaffold and asked if he was sorry for what he'd done, he replied, yes, he was sorry for having let them off so easy. And he hoped all Christian husbands would pardon him the offence. Let that be a warning to all young ladies to be particular in the character of the gentleman of their choice. Observe that his fingers is curled as if in the act of tickling. And his face is represented with a wink as he appeared when committing his barbarous murders.
Dickens came from the lower middle class, and he hated it. The anatomy of our class system is such that the lower middle class is probably the worst class to be born into, because it lacks both the dignity of the working class and the security, the confidence of the middle class. So anyone who has the misfortune to be born into the lower middle class can spend a lifetime trying to claw their way out of it. Dickens was a passionate and a determined and ultimately a successful social climber. But his childhood was shrouded with debt and disgrace. His grandfather was forced to flee the country because he was caught embezzling the funds of the Navy Pay Office where he worked. And Dickens' father, John Dickens, who wasn't a criminal, he was a feckless man, hopeless with money. And when Dickens was only 12 years old, his father was finally arrested for owing the baker £40. The whole family was taken and jailed in the Marshalsea Debtors' Prison in London, all except for Charles Dickens himself. His parents sent him to board with a Mrs. Elizabeth Roylance, a reduced old lady long known to our family in Little College Street, Camden Town, who took children in to board and had done so in Brighton. She is the inspiration for Mrs. Pipchin, here confronting little Paul Dombey in Dombey and Son. This celebrated Mrs. Pipchin was a marvellous, ill-favoured, ill-conditioned old lady of a stooping figure with a mottled face like bad marble, a hook nose and a hard grey eye that looked as if it might have been hammered at on an anvil without sustaining any injury. 40 years at least had elapsed since the death of Mr. Pipchin, but his relict still wore black bombazine of such a lustreless, deep, dead, sombre shade that gas itself couldn't light her up after dark. She was generally held to be a great manager of children, and the secret of her management was to give them everything that they didn't like and nothing that they did.
which were said to sweeten their dispositions very much. "Well, sir," said Mrs. Pipchin to Paul, "how do you think you shall like me?"
"I don't think I shall like you at all," said Paul. "I want to go away. This isn't my house."
"No," said Mrs. Pipchin. "It's mine."
"It's a very nasty one," said Paul.
"There's a worse place in it than this, though," said Mrs. Pipchin, "where we shut up our bad boys." Mrs. Pipchin always made a point of being particularly cross on Sunday nights. And there, with an aching void in his young heart, and all around so cold and bare and strange, Paul sat as if he had taken life unfurnished and the upholsterer was never coming. For the rest of his life, Dickens felt himself to be a deprived child. He wrote of Florence Dombey, but really it was of himself. Not an orphan in the wide world can be so deserted as the child who is an outcast from a living parent's love. And the core of the resentment that he felt stems from his feelings about his mother. The family was always terribly poor, and Mrs. Elizabeth Dickens always fanatically trying to keep up appearances, like Mrs. Micawber in David Copperfield.
"I never thought, before I was married, when I lived with Papa and Mama, that I should ever find it necessary to take a lodger. But Mr. Micawber being in difficulties, all considerations of private feelings must give way. Mr. Micawber's difficulties are almost overwhelming just at present, and whether it is possible to bring him through them, I don't know. If Mr. Micawber's creditors will not give him time, they must take the consequences, and the sooner they bring it to an issue, the better. Blood cannot be obtained from a stone. Neither can anything on account be obtained at present from Mr. Micawber. With the exception of the heel of a Dutch cheese, which is not adapted to the wants of a young family, there really is not a scrap of anything in the larder." I was accustomed to speak of the larder when I lived with Papa and Mama, and I used the words almost unconsciously. What I mean to express is, there is nothing to eat in the house. I have pawned the plate myself. 6 tea, 2 salt, and a pair of sugars I have at various times borrowed money on in secret with my own hands. And to me, with my recollections of Papa and Mama, these transactions are very painful. Oh, there are still a few trifles we could part with, but Mr. Micawber's feelings would never allow him to dispose of them, and Clickett, being of a vulgar mind, would take painful liberties if so much confidence was reposed in her. Master Copperfield, if I might ask you, my family may consider it a banishment if they will, but I'm a wife and mother, and I will never desert Mr. Micawber. That is my view of the obligation I took upon myself when I repeated the irrevocable words, 'I, Emma, take thee, Wilkins.' I read the service over with a flat candle on the previous night, And the conclusion I derived from it was that I could never desert Mr. Micawber. And though it is possible I may be mistaken in my view of the ceremony, I never will.
Dickens is so wonderful with names. Wilkins Micawber is perfect. You can see sometimes from his notebooks how he arrived at the various names. Mrs. Pipchin, for example, started off as Mrs. Tipchin. Then Mrs. Allchin, Mrs. Sumchin, Mrs. Pipchin. It's brilliant. So, after a few months, the family was finally released from the Marshalsea prison. But Dickens had already been sent to work by his parents for 6 shillings a week in a shoe-blacking factory at number 30 Hungerford Stairs, just off the Strand. It was the worst time of his whole life. He could never go past that address for the rest of his life without crossing the road, and he never spoke of it to anyone. The extraordinary thing is that even as a little boy, and he was only 12 years old, he had such a sense of himself, such a belief in his own destiny, that he felt humiliated because the passers-by could see him through the factory windows pasting the labels on the blacking bottles. And he felt it the more keenly because his sister Fanny had just won a scholarship to the Royal Academy of Music. And while he was toiling away in the dirt, she was learning the graces of singing and piano. He had one friend there, a carroty-headed little boy called Bob Fagin. But he begged his parents to take him away and send him back to school. And one day, his father had a quarrel with the manager of the factory, James Lammert, and he came and fetched him home. But the very next morning, his mother went back to Mr. Lammert, trying to persuade him to keep Dickens working. 20 years later, in an autobiographical fragment that was never published in his lifetime, he wrote of the pain of that realization. I never afterwards forgot. I never shall forget. I never can forget that my mother was warm for my being sent back. And that one incident coloured the whole of his attitudes towards women for the rest of his life. Nevertheless, he was a dutiful son. He took care of his mother financially after his father died. He wrote rather ruefully, "My mother was left me when my father died. I never had anything left me but relations." It was different with his grandmother. She was in service. She was the housekeeper to the Earl of Crewe. And he loved listening to her stories when he was a little boy. He draws an affectionate portrait of her as Mrs. Lirriper, the lodging housekeeper from Household Words.
It was early in the second year of my married life that I lost my poor Lirriper, and I set up at Islington directly afterwards, and afterwards came here. Girls are one of your first and one of your lasting troubles, being like your teeth, which begin with convulsions and never cease tormenting you from the time you cut them till they cut you. And then you don't want to part with them, which seems hard, but we must all succumb or by artificial. And even when there's a will, 9 times out of 10 there's a dirty face with it. And naturally lodgers do not like good society to be shown in with a smear of black across the nose or a smudgy eyebrow. Where they pick up the black is a mystery I cannot solve. As in the case of the willingest girl that ever came into a house half starved, poor thing. A girl so willing I called her Willing Sophie. Down on her knees, scrubbing early and late, and ever cheerful and always smiling, with a black face. And I says to her, Sophie, my good girl, have a regular day for your stoves, and keep the width of the area between yourself and the blacking. And do not brush your hair with the bottoms of the saucepans, and do not meddle with the snuffs of the candles. And it stands to reason that it cannot be. Yet there it was, and always on her nose, which turning up and being broad at the end seemed to boast of it, and caused warning from an excellent gentleman and steady lodger, breakfast by the week, use of sitting room when required. His words being, Mrs. Lirriper, I am at the point of admitting that the black is a man and a brother, but only in a natural form, and when it can't be got off. Well, consequently, I put poor Sophie on to other work, and I absolutely forbade her to answer the door, answer a bell on any account. But she was unfortunately so willing that nothing would stop her from flying up the kitchen stairs whenever the bell was heard to tingle. And I said, Sophie, for goodness sake, where does it come from? To which that poor, unlucky, willing mortal, bursting out crying to see me so vexed, replied, I took a deal of black into me mum as a small child, being much neglected, and I think it must be that it works out. Well, it continuing to work out of that poor soul, and not having another fault to find with her, I said, Sophie, what do you seriously think of my helping you away to New South Wales, where it might not be noticed? Nor did I ever repent me of the money, which was well spent, for she married the ship's cook on the voyage, himself a muleteer, and did well, and lived happy. And so far as ever I heard, it was not noticed in a new state of society till her dying day.
When Dickens was 18, he was working as a reporter in the Houses of Parliament, and he fell madly and passionately and explosively in love with a frivolous little creature called Maria Beadnell. David Copperfield meeting Dora Spenlow is Charles Dickens meeting Maria Beadnell. All was over in a moment. I had fulfilled my destiny. I was a captive and a slave. I loved Dora Spenlow to distraction. She was more than a human to me. She was a fairy, a sylph. I don't know what she was. Anything that no one ever saw, and everything that everybody ever wanted. But to Dickens' regret, Maria's parents did not want their daughter affianced to a debtor's son with no prospects. And Maria herself was very naughty. She teased him and led him on, and then she spurned him, calling him a mere boy. Boy. B-O-Y. Three letters which he wrote scorched his brain. He never got over it. Actually, Dickens never got over anything that happened. Years later, when Maria came back into his life, he wrote to her. Nobody can ever know with what a sad heart I resigned you, or after what struggles and what conflict. my entire devotion to you and the wasted tenderness of those hard years, which I have ever since half loved, half dreaded to recall, made so deep an impression on me that I refer to it a habit of suppression which I now have, which I know is no part of my original nature, but which makes me chary of showing my affections, even to my own children, except when they're very young. Now, in 1855, when Maria came back into his life, she was not Miss Beadnell anymore. She had become Mrs. Henry Winter, the wife of an impoverished sawmill manager in Finsbury. Did she make a mistake? And she wrote to him. He was, of course, by now the most famous writer in England. When he saw her handwriting on the envelope, that well-remembered handwriting, his heart flamed into a frenzy of expectation. Very naughtily, he replied immediately, making an assignation with her at a time that he knew that his wife, Catherine, would not be at home. He wrote, "I fancy, though you may not have thought how manfully I loved you, that you have seen in one of my old books a faithful recollection of the passion I had for you, and may have thought that it was something to have been loved so well, and may have seen in little bits of Dora touches of your old self sometimes, and a grace here and there that may be revived in your little girls years hence for the bewilderment of some other young lover, though he will never be as dreadfully in earnest as I and David Copperfield were." So they arranged to meet. And the extraordinary thing is that this brilliant man had kept alive in his mind the image of Maria as she had been when they had last met 19 years before. She tried to warn him in a letter that she had changed. Well, you would, wouldn't you? He replied, "When you say that you are toothless, fat, old and ugly, which I don't believe, I fly away to the house in Lombard Street and I see you in a sort of raspberry-coloured dress with a row of black Van Dykes at the top and my boyish heart pinned like a captured butterfly to every one of them." She arrived, 19 years older, and shattered his dreams. He could never forgive her for having grown older. And he took his literary revenge when he wrote the character of Flora Finching in Little Dorrit.
"I'm sure I'm ashamed to see Mr. Clennam. I'm a mere fright. I know he'll find me fearfully changed. I'm actually an old woman. It's shocking to be found out. It's really shocking." "Oh, but with a gentleman, it's so different. And really, you look so amazingly well. You've no right to say anything of the kind. Well, as to me, you know, I'm dreadful. But if we talk of not having changed, look at Papa. Is not Papa precisely what he was when you went away? Isn't it cruel and unnatural of Papa to be such a reproach to his own child? If we go on in this way much longer, people who don't know us will come to suppose I'm Papa's Mama. You insincerest of creatures. I perceive already you've not lost your old way of paying compliments. Your old way when you used to pretend to be so sentimentally struck, you know. At least I don't mean that. I don't know what I mean. You're not thinking of going yet. You could never be so unkind as to think of going, Arthur. I mean, Mr. Clennam, far more proper. Oh, I don't know what I'm saying. I'm running into nonsense again. Indeed, I have no doubt that you are married already to some Chinese lady. Well, being in China so long and being in business and naturally desirous to settle and extend your connection, nothing was more likely that you should propose to a Chinese lady, and nothing was more natural that the Chinese lady should accept you and think herself very well off too. I only hope she's not a Pagodian dissenter. Oh, Good gracious me. I hope you never kept yourself a bachelor so long on my account. No, of course you never did. Why ever should you? Pray don't ask, I'm running into nonsense again. No, tell me something of the Chinese ladies. Whether their eyes are really so long and narrow, always putting me in mind of mother of pearl fish at cards, and do they really wear tails down their backs and plaited too? Or is it only the men? Why do they stick little bells all over their bridges and temples and hats and things? Or don't they really do it? Oh, then it's all true and they really do. Good gracious, Arthur. Oh, old habit, Mr. Clennam, far more proper. Dear, dear, only to think of the changes at home. Who could have ever imagined Mrs. Finching when I can't imagine it myself? Yes, Finching. It's a dreadful name, isn't it? Oh, as Mr. F. said when he proposed to me, he wasn't answerable for it and couldn't help it, could he? Excellent man. Not at all like you, but excellent man. Oh, romance was fled, as I openly said to Mr. F. when he proposed to me, which, you'll be surprised to hear, he did 7 times. Once in a hackney coach, once in a boat, once in a pew, once on a donkey at Tunbridge Wells, and the rest on his knees. Oh, I feel, you know, because I carry it stamped in burning what's-its-names upon my brow, that before I was introduced to the late Mr. F., I'd been engaged to Arthur Clennam. We were all in all to one another. It was the morning of life. It was bliss. It was frenzy. It was everything else of that sort in the highest degree. When rent asunder, we were turned to stone. In which capacity, Arthur went to China and I became the statue bride of the late Mr. F. Ask me not if I love him still, or if he loves me, or what the end is to be or when. We are surrounded by watchful eyes. It may be destined to pine asunder, never more to be reunited. Not a look, not a word, not a breath must betray us. All must be secret as the tomb. Wonder not, therefore, that even if I should seem comparatively cold to Arthur, or Arthur should seem comparatively cold to me, we have fatal reasons. It is enough if we understand them. Hush. Dear me, is that Mr. Bumble?
At your service, ma'am,
said Mr. Bumble, who'd been stopping outside to rub his shoes clean and to shake the snow off his coat, and who now made his appearance bearing a cocked hat in one hand and a stick in the other.
Shall I shut the door, ma'am?
The lady modestly hesitated to reply, lest there should be any impropriety in holding an interview with Mr. Bumble with closed doors. Mr. Bumble, being very cold himself and taking advantage of her hesitation, shut it without permission.
Hard weather, Mr. Bumble.
Hard indeed, ma'am. Anti-parochial weather this, ma'am. We have given away, Mrs. Corley, we have given away a matter of 20 quartern loaves and a cheese and a half this very blessed afternoon, and yet them paupers is not contented.
Of course not, Mr. Bumble. When would they be?
Well, that's the way with these people, ma'am. Give them an apron full of coals today, and they'll come back for another the day after tomorrow. As brazen as alabaster. Mrs. Corney, the great principle of out-of-door relief is to give them paupers exactly what they don't want, and then they get tired of coming.
Oh, dear me, that's a good one too.
Mr. Bumble took up his hat and stick as if to go.
You'll have a very cold walk, Mr. Bumble.
It blows, ma'am, enough to cut one's ears off.
The matron looked from the little kettle to the beadle, who was moving towards the door, and as the beadle coughed, preparatory to bidding her good night, bashfully inquired whether
whether he wouldn't take a cup of tea.
Mr. Bumble instantaneously turned his collar back again, laid his hat and stick upon a chair, and drew another chair up to the table. As he slowly seated himself, he looked at the lady. Mrs. Corney applied herself to the task of making his tea.
Sweet, Mr. Bumble.
Very sweet indeed, ma'am.
He fixed his eyes on Mrs. Corney as he said this, and if ever a beadle looked tender, Mr. Bumble was that beadle at that moment.
You have a cat, ma'am, I see. And kittings, too, I declare.
Oh, yes. I'm so fond of them, you can't imagine. They're so happy, so frolicsome, and so cheerful. They're quite companions for me.
Very nice animals, ma'am. So very, domestic.
Oh, yes. And so fond of their home, too. It's quite a pleasure, I'm sure.
Mrs. Corney, ma'am, I mean to say this, ma'am, but any cat or kitting that could live with you and not be fond of its home must be a ass, ma'am.
Oh, Mr. Bumble.
It's a no use disguising facts, ma'am,
said Mr. Bumble, slowly flourishing his teaspoon with a kind of amorous dignity which made him doubly impressive.
I would drown it myself with pleasure.
Then you're a cruel man, and a very hard-hearted man besides.
Hard-hearted, Mrs. Corney? Hard?
Mr. Bumble relinquished his cup without another word, squeezed Mrs. Corney's little finger as she took it, and inflicting two open-handed slabs upon his laced waistcoat, gave a mighty sigh, and hitched his chair a very little morsel farther from the fire. It was a round table. Consequently, Mr. Bumble, moving his chair by little and little, soon began to diminish the distance between himself and the matron, and continuing to travel round the outer edge of the circle, brought his chair in time close to that in which the matron was seated. Indeed, the two chairs touched. And when they did do, Mr. Bumble stopped.
Hard-hearted, Mrs. Corney. Are you hard-hearted?
Dear me, what a very curious question from a single man. What can you want to know for, Mr. Bumble?
Mr. Bumble drank his tea down to the last drop, finished a piece of toast, whisked the crumbs from his knees, wiped his lips, and deliberately kissed the matron.
Oh, Mr. Bumble, I shall scream. I'm only a foolish, excitable, weak creature.
Not weak, ma'am. Are you a weak creature, Mrs. Gorman?
We're all weak creatures, Mr. Bumble.
So we are.
Nothing was said on either side for a moment or two afterwards.
This is a weary, comfortable room, ma'am. Another room, and this, ma'am, would be a complete thing.
Then it would be too much for one.
But not for two. Eh, Mrs. Corney? The board allows you coals, don't they, Mrs. Corney?
And candles.
Coals, candles, and a house rent-free. Oh, Mrs. Corney. What an angel you are.
The lady was not proof against this burst of feeling and sank into Mr. Bumble's arms. That gentleman, in his agitation, imprinted a passionate kiss upon her chaste nose.
Such parochial perfection. You know that Mr. Slout is worse tonight, my fascinator.
Yes.
He is the master of this establishment. His death will cause a vacancy. That vacancy must be filled up. Oh, Mrs. Corney, what a prospect this opens. What an opportunity for a joining of hearts and housekeepings. The little word, eh? The one little word, my blessed Corney.
Yes!
I love doing that. Sexual greed and economic greed in the same scene. One of the most terrifying fates which could await a respectable Victorian woman was to remain unmarried, to be a spinster. Dickens certainly thought so. His description of Rosa Dartle: I concluded in my own mind that she was about 30 years of age and wished to be married. She was a little dilapidated, like a house, with having been so long to let. And Miss Nag, who still aimed at youth, though she had shot beyond it years ago. And Miss Lucretia Tox, a long, lean figure, wearing such a faded air that she seemed not to have been made in what linen drapers call fast colours originally. Miss Tox had great experience in hackney cabs, and her starting in one was generally a work of time, as she was systematic in the preparatory arrangement. Have the goodness, if you please, Towlinson, to carry out a pen and ink and take his number legibly.
Yes, miss.
I'll trouble you also, Towlinson, with this card and this shilling. He's to drive to the card and is to understand that he will not on any account have more than the shilling.
No, miss.
And I am sorry to give you this trouble, Towlinson.
Not at all, miss.
Mention to the man, then, if you please, Towlinson, that the lady's uncle is a magistrate, and that if he gives her any of his impertinence, he will be punished. Terribly. You can pretend to say this in a friendly way, Towlinson. And because you know it was done to another man who died.
Oh, dear.
As you probably know, most of Dickens' novels were first published in serial form, in monthly instalments. And in one episode of David Copperfield, he introduced an extraordinary character. Her name is Miss Moucher, a
and she's a dwarf manicurist and hairdresser. She's based on a real diminutive chiropodist called Mrs. Seymour Hill, whom Dickens had met when she'd attended his wife, Catherine.
What, my flower? You're there, are you, you naughty boy? Fie for shame. What you do so far away from home? Up to mischief, I'll be bound. Ooh, you're a downy fellow, Steerforth. So you are. And I'm another and I... Oh, you'd have betted £100 to £5 now that you wouldn't have seen me here, wouldn't you? Bless you, man alive. I'm everywhere. I'm here and there and where not. Like the conjurer's half crown in the lady's handkerchief. Talking of ladies and talking of handkerchiefs, what a comfort you are to your blessed mother, ain't you, my dear boy? Over one of my shoulders, and I don't say which. Oh, my stars, and what's the names? Oh, I'm of too full a habit, Steerforth, and that's a fact. After a flight of stairs, it gives me as much trouble to draw every breath I want as if it was a bucket of water. If you saw me looking out of an upper window, you'd think I was a fine woman, wouldn't you? Oh, very happy to make your acquaintance, Master Copperfield, I'm sure. Face like a peach, quite tempting. I'm very fond of peaches. What a world of gammon and spinach it is, though, isn't it? Look here. Scraps of the Russian prince's nails. I keep his nails in order for him twice a week, fingers and toes. The prince's nails do more for me in private families of the genteel sort than all my talents put together. I always carry them around. They're the best introduction. If Miss Moucher cuts the prince's nail, she must be all right. I'll give them to the young ladies. They put them in albums, I believe. Steerforth, this is not business. Let's explore the polar regions, and have it over. If either of you saw my ankle, say so, and I'll go home and destroy myself. Very well, then, I'll consent to live. Now, ducky, 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 come to Mrs. Bond and be killed. If Master Copperfield will take the chair, I'll operate on him too. And dirt cheap, my chicken. And I'm volatile, Master Copperfield. Now, I'm going to break your heart, but I'm forced to leave you. You must call up all your fortitude and try to bear it. Goodbye, Master Copperfield. Farewell, Jockey of Norfolk. Bob swore, as the Englishman said for good night when he first learnt French and thought it so much like English. Bob swore me, Jax, and time volatile.
When the original Miss Moucher, Mrs. Seymour Hill, read that chapter of David Copperfield, she was mortified. She wrote angrily to Dickens, "All know you have drawn my portrait. I admit it. But the vulgar slang of language I deny." Dickens had not meant to hurt her, and for once his compassion overcame his writer's instinct. He replied to her lawyer, apologising and offering to alter the whole design of the character. He did. And the next time Miss Moucher appears in the novel, she's a completely different person. Utterly saintly and very boring, so I shan't do her. A woman's portrait that is startling in its modernity is the lesbian Miss Wade from Little Dorrit, making no apologies for anything. The history of a self-tormentor.
I have the misfortune of not being a fool. From a very early age, I have detected what those about me thought they hid from me. My childhood was passed with a grandmother. That is to say, with a lady who took that title on herself. She had no claim to it. She had some children of her own family in the house and some children of other people. All girls, 10 in number, including me. We all lived together and were educated together. I must have been about 12 years old when I began to realize how determinedly those girls patronized me. One of them was my chosen friend. I loved that stupid mite in a passionate way that she could no more deserve than I can remember without feeling ashamed of, though I was but a child. She had what they call an amiable temper, an affectionate temper. She could distribute, and did distribute, pretty looks and smiles to everyone among them. I believe there was not a person in the place except myself who knew that she did it purposely to wound and gall me. Nevertheless, I so loved that unworthy girl that my life was made stormy by my fondness for her. I loved her faithfully. And one time I went home with her for the holidays. She was worse at home than she had been at school. She had a crowd of cousins and acquaintances, and we had dances at her house and went to dances at other houses. And both at home and out, she tormented my love beyond endurance. Her plan was to make them fond of her, and so drive me wild with jealousy. When we were alone in our bedroom at night, I would reproach her with my perfect knowledge of her baseness. And she would cry and say I was cruel. And I would hold her in my arms till morning, loving her as much as ever, and often feeling as if rather than suffer so, I could still so hold her in my arms and plunge to the bottom of a river, where I would still hold her after we both were dead.
You see, he's such an extraordinary writer because he can create a character like that with such power and truth and understanding, I think, and yet at the same time be such a chauvinist that if he hadn't made us laugh so much when we were searching for this, he'd have made us very angry. For example, this is his portrait of a perfect wife, Mrs. Chirrup from Scenes for Young Couples. Mrs. Chirrup is the prettiest of all little women and has the prettiest little figure conceivable. She has the neatest little foot and the softest little voice and the gentlest little smile and the tidiest little curls and the brightest little eyes and is, in short, altogether one of the most engaging of all little women, dead or alive.
She's a condensation of all the domestic virtues, a pocket edition of the young man's best companion. A little woman at a very high pressure, with an amazing quantity of goodness and usefulness in an exceedingly small space. But if there be one branch of housekeeping at which she excels, it is in the important one of carving. Charles Dickens married Catherine Hogarth in 1836. And the most extraordinary thing about the marriage is its ending. A friend, Henry Morley, described her. Dickens has evidently made a comfortable choice. Mrs. Dickens is stout, with a round, very round, rather pretty, very pleasant face, and ringlets on either side of it. One sees in 5 minutes that she loves her husband and her children, and has a warm heart for anyone who won't be satirical. But we'll meet her on her own good-natured footing. Well, the years went by, and the children kept coming. 12 births in 16 years. Catherine grew older and stouter and clumsier. Dickens wrote, "Catherine is as near being a donkey as one of her sex can be." And Harriet Martineau commented after a visit to them, "Dickens has terrified and depressed her into a dull condition, and she never was very clever." Now, one of Dickens' abiding enthusiasms was the theatre. In fact, as a young man, if he hadn't had a cold on the morning of his audition at Drury Lane Theatre, he would have become a professional actor. And all his life, he adored putting on plays and acting in them. In 1856, he produced, directed, and starred in his friend Wilkie Collins' melodrama, The Frozen Deep, and he used his two daughters in the female roles. But the following year, when he wanted to recreate the production in Manchester, he decided to use professional actresses instead. He was introduced to and engaged two sisters, Maria Ternan and her younger sister, Ellen. Ellen was a young, slender, beautiful, little thing, and he fell hopelessly in love with her. He was 45 years old, and she was 17. He bought her a bracelet as a present, but it was delivered by mistake to his wife, Catherine. One day, their daughter Kate came into Mrs. Dickens' bedroom and found her tying on her bonnet with tears pouring down her face. "Your father insists that I call on Ellen Ternan," she said. "You shall not go," said Kate. But she did. You see, Dickens' most passionate relationship was always with his public, and he was terrified of losing their affections. He was determined to devise an acceptable situation. So he suggested to Catherine that she should go and live at Gad's Hill, their country house, while he stayed in London, and only come to London when he went to the country. Catherine refused. Then he suggested that she should go and live in France while he stayed in England. Catherine refused. Finally, and most bizarre of all, he suggested to Catherine that she should keep to the upstairs rooms of their house at Tavistock Street and only come downstairs when they were entertaining visitors. He got rid of Catherine. But he retained her sister, Georgina, Mary's replacement, who'd come to live with her when she was 15, and she never left. She stayed in Dickens' house, looking after Dickens and her sister's children, until he died. In fact, he died in Georgina's arms, and she is the principal beneficiary in his will. They were never lovers, I don't think that, but he had a very strange affinity for his sisters-in-law. Further to retain that precious affection of his publics, he published a letter on the front page of his own magazine, Household Words, and in the Times and the Morning Post, and later in the New York Tribune, a letter to the public
in which he said that he and his wife had lived unhappily together for many years, that she had been a bad mother and had lost the affections of her children, and that she was of unsound mind. Catherine never responded to these calumnies. He wanted to publish that letter also in Punch, the foremost comic magazine of the day, and was furious when the editor, his friend Mark Lemon, refused because he didn't think it was very funny. Dickens did not speak to him again for 12 years. So finally, a separation settlement was drawn up. Dickens gave Catherine £600 a year, her own house, number 70, Gloucester Crescent, her own carriage, and one of her 9 surviving children. He sent the eldest, Charles, to live with her. At the time that they left, her youngest child, Edward, known as Plawn, was only 6 years old. So the carriage bearing Catherine and Charles rolled away for its long stay at Gloucester Crescent. She lived there for 22 years. From the day that she left, she never saw Dickens again. She only saw her 2 daughters when they came for their music lessons to the house opposite. Catherine would stand in the upstairs window, looking through the lace curtains, waiting for her daughters to turn and wave at her as they went inside. But they never did. They were reconciled only after Dickens had died, and Kate was with her mother when Catherine was dying. Catherine handed her daughter a little bundle of letters tied up in blue ribbon. They were Charles Dickens' first letters to her. She said, "Give these to the British Museum, that the world may know he loved me once." Catherine is buried in Highgate Cemetery, next to her baby daughter, Dora. Ellen Ternan married a clergyman and lived on till 1914. By an extraordinary coincidence, she's buried in Southsea in the same graveyard as Dickens' other great love, Maria Beadnell, Mrs. Henry Winter. But Maria lies in an unmarked pauper's grave. At the time of the separation, Dickens was writing Little Dorrit. So, the bride had mounted into her handsome chariot, and after rolling for a few minutes smoothly over a fair pavement, had begun to jolt through a slough of despond and through a long, long avenue of rack and ruin. Other nuptial carriages are said to have gone the same road before and since. In an armchair, with an elbow resting on the table and her head leaning on that hand, sat the strangest lady I have ever seen or shall ever see. She was dressed in rich materials, satins and lace and silks, all of white. Her shoes were white, and she had a long white veil and bridal flowers in her hair. But her hair was white. She had not quite finished dressing, for she had but one shoe on. The other was on the table near her hand. I saw that everything within my view which ought to be white had been white long ago, and had lost its luster and was faded and yellow. I saw that the dress had been put upon the rounded figure of a young woman, and that the figure upon which it now hung loose had shrunk to skin and bone. "Who is it?" "Pip!"
Mom?
Pip?
Mr. Pumblechook's boy, Mom. Come to play.
Come nearer. Let me look at you. Come close.
When I stood before her, avoiding her eyes, I took note of the surrounding objects in detail. I saw that her watch had stopped at 9:20, and that a clock in the room had stopped at 9:20.
Look at me. You are not afraid to look at a woman who has not seen the sun since you were born. Do you know what I touch here?
Yes, Mom.
What do I touch?
Your heart, Mom.
Broken. I'm tired, and I have done with men and women. I have sick fancies, and I have a sick fancy I should like to see some play. There, there. Play. Play? Play. Call Estella at the door. You can do that.
To stand in the dark, in a mysterious passage of an unknown house, bawling, Estella! To a young lady neither visible nor responsive, and feeling it a dreadful liberty so as to roar out her name, was almost as bad as playing to order. But Estella answered at last, and her light came along the dark passage like a star. Miss Havisham beckoned her to come close, and took up a jewel from the table, and tried its effect upon her fair young bosom and her pretty brown hair.
Let me see you play at cards with this boy.
With this boy? Why, he's nothing but a common laboring boy.
Well, you can break his heart.
What do you play, boy?
Nothing but beggar my neighbor, miss.
Beggar him,
said Miss Havisham to Estella. So we sat down to cards. I played the game to an end with Estella, and she beggared me. Then, Estella being gone, and we two left alone, Miss Havisham turned to me and said in a whisper,
Is she beautiful, graceful, well-grown? Do you admire her? Love her, love her, love her. If she favors you, love her. If she wounds you, love her. If she tears your heart to pieces, and as it grows older and stronger, it will tear deeper. Love her. Love her. Love her. Hear me, Pip. I adopted her to be loved. I bred her and educated her to be loved. I developed her into what she is, that she might be loved. Love her. I'll tell you what real love is. It is blind devotion, unquestioning self-humiliation, utter submission, trust and belief against yourself and against the whole world, giving up your whole heart and soul to the smiter. As
I did.
Some people say that Estella is Ellen Ternan. I think that Miss Havisham is Dickens himself. He died in 1870. He described himself to his great friend John Forster as a misplaced and mismarried man, always, as it were, playing hide and seek with the world, and never finding what fortune seems to have hidden when he was born. I'd like to leave you with his tenderest portrait, Miss Flight from Bleak House. Miss Flight is a crazy little old lady who goes every single day to the High Court of Chancery, awaiting a judgment on her inheritance. A judgment that may never come. I have lived here many years. I pass my days in court, my evenings and my nights here. I find the nights long, for I sleep but little and think much. That is, of course, unavoidable, being in Chancery. I am sorry, I cannot offer chocolate. I expect a judgment shortly, and shall then place my establishment on a superior footing. At present, I don't mind confessing, in strict confidence, that I sometimes find it difficult to keep up a genteel appearance. I have felt the cold here. I have felt something sharper than cold. It makes no matter. Pray excuse the introduction of such mean topics. Ah, my birds. I began to keep the little creatures with an object you will readily comprehend, with the intention of restoring them to liberty when my judgment should be given. They die in prison, though. Their lives, poor silly things, are so short in comparison with chancery proceedings that one by one the whole collection has died, over and over again. But I expect a judgment shortly. My father expected a judgment. My brother. My sister. They all expected a judgment. The same that I expect. Yes. All dead, of course. But I must tell you a secret. I have added to my collection of birds two more. I call them the wards in Jarndyce. They are caged up with all the others, with hope, joy, youth, peace, rest, life, dust, ashes, waste, want, ruin, despair, madness, death, cunning, folly, words, wigs, rags, sheepskin, plunder, precedent, jargon, gammon, and spinach.
Thank you.
All of Dickens' women were played by Miriam Margolyes. She was accompanied at the piano by Michael Haslam. The production was directed for the theatre by Sonia Fraser and for radio by Enid Williams.